All right, I have gone through my disclaimers, and I think at this point it's time for me to turn the floor over to your first presenter. So I see Emmy is coming on camera. Emmy, I'm going to turn the floor over to you, call up those, let you provide an introduction. We'll talk about the series, and then we'll bring up the presentation slides.
All right, sounds great. Thank you so much, Jane. And thank you to everybody who's joined us today. It's great to see everyone logging in. We're very excited. Again, this is one of the webinars from our Federal Facilities Academy. We offer these webinars every 2 years to make sure we're getting the latest and greatest to you all. And it is part of a larger effort, which is voluntary, but really trying to help not only our EPA RPMs, but as well as project managers from other federal agencies, state government, and tribal groups who work on federal facilities Superfund cleanups to be able to learn more about the nuances of implementing Superfund at our federal facilities. If you missed a webinar, but you're still interested in completing the academy, these are archived, so you can view them at your convenience and earn a certificate of completion. And once you have those 11 webinars completed, along with a 3-day classroom training, I have to say these webinars are open to the public, while the 3-day classroom training is typically a more limited audience to federal, state, and tribal partners. But if you are able to complete all 12 of the classes, we can issue you a certificate of completion, which is issued by the director of the EPA Superfund Federal Facilities Program. It's just a great way to show your management you're putting in that extra time and effort to really understand CERCLA and be able to implement it consistently across various sites. And I think that's my plug, Jean, for the
All
Academy.
right, excellent, Emmy. And then just a quick reminder, as she's saying, there are 11 webinars open to the public and that one classroom delivery with private, or pardon, with a limited audience. So you can take those webinars live online, replay the archived version, and then for that in-person classroom training, you if you qualify and are part of that limited delivery audience, you must attend that in person. You can get certificates of participation for any of the webinars, whether you take them live, you replay them, any combination of live or archived. I'll talk you through how to get a certificate of participation for each one of those webinars. And then, as Emmy just highlighted, you'll get that Academy certificate if you do all of the webinars, either live or replayed, and then attend that in-person live delivery. All right, Emmy, I think that's the end of those reminders. Let's call up your presentation content, and I will turn the floor over to you.
Awesome, thank you so much. So let's go ahead and get into our content for today. We are looking at community involvement at federal facilities. So what we'll be discussing today really is focusing on those sites that are on the National Priorities List, the NPL, and are being cleaned up under Superfund, or rather CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. So we'll go essentially through the Superfund process and talk about the community involvement activities that are required, as well as those that are recommended throughout that process. And we'll take time to specifically provide a case study and discuss environmental justice considerations as well. But let's go ahead and jump into the lead agency role with community involvement. So this is one of those nuances that makes federal facilities the same but different when it comes to implementing Superfund. So the lead agency is defined in the National Contingency Plan, the NCP, and it states that the lead agency, essentially that agency that's responsible for cleanup of a site, is the one that provides the on-scene coordinators and remedial project managers. I know that can be confusing because EPA provides RPMs to conduct oversight at our various federal facilities, but this is specifically speaking to those that are identified by the lead agency. So for Department of Defense or Department of Energy sites, they are the lead agency. DoD or DOE are the lead agency for those sites. And then for other federal facilities that are on the NPL that are not EPAs or US Coast Guard, DoD, or DOE, then it's that federal agency who will be the lead, be it if it's the VA or if it's NASA. They various federal agencies have sites on the NPL, so they would be considered the lead. Another thing that comes with being the lead cleanup agency is that that agency is the one who pays for the cleanup, essentially out of their budgets, and that includes conducting community involvement activities. Going a little bit further with the role of federal agencies, I've mentioned at those sites that other federal agency, not EPA, is the lead cleanup agency. But then you have your regulators. So EPA is the federal regulator for oversight. And often through a federal facilities agreement, which I'll talk about more in just a second, you also have your state regulator who's playing their role. But part of those roles are ensuring that all the community involvement requirements are being met. And even beyond that, that meaningful community participation is happening at these sites. You don't want your goal to be, oh, let's just check the box. The NCP requires us to do XYZ. We did XYZ. We're good to go. It's a little more complicated than that. You're looking at the needs of the community, the desires of the community. How do you get them involved at their level? And what does that meaningful engagement look like? Because it's not a one size fits all. It is going to vary from site to site, depending on the needs of the community. But overall, it is going to require that your state and federal team members are working together to ensure that this is happening. I mentioned federal facilities agreements just a bit ago. So at our federal facility agreement sites that are on the NPL, it's required that an interagency agreement be entered. These are called FFAs, federal facility agreements. They are site specific. They lay out roles and responsibilities for all of the parties, typically your lead agency, EPA, and a state agency. And it will lay out all of those responsibilities. Typically, there's also what's known as a site management plan, but they're called different things. It might be a milestone schedule, a schedule for cleanup. It depends on the site and how old the document is. But this is a component of most federal facilities agreements, and it's going to identify, what's the timeline for cleanup? What are the major milestones? What other necessary documents, have to be issued to allow cleanup to proceed? So it's very important that whatever role you're playing at a site, be it a remedial project manager, a community involvement coordinator, whatever role that may be, that you're familiar with the site's FFA, because there could be additional requirements in that document beyond what the NCP has that you should be aware of, because it opens up liabilities if you're not completing those tasks or ensuring those tasks are being completed at your site. So that's definitely an important part to keep in mind. For EPA's primary role, granted, we're not the lead agency, we're not paying for the cleanup out of our budgets, but we are providing oversight. So when it comes to community involvement, we want to make sure that we are correctly informing the lead agency of what those requirements are. Never assume that everybody just knows because of turnover, new people coming into site teams. They may not know. So it's important that as regulatory agencies or as a regulatory agency that you are making those requirements known and ensuring that they're being met as needed. All right, the next thing I wanted to touch on was a great tool that EPA has. And we have the links in the participant manual if you've downloaded that, or we can drop a link in the chat to the Superfund Community Involvement Handbook. This is a great tool. It lays out so much information concisely, so you're not searching through pages and pages or multiple web searches of the NCP trying to figure out what's required. Highly, highly recommend that you bookmark this document so you can refer to it in the future. But one of the items in that document is at federal facility sites, what should EPA be doing? So if you're an RPM for EPA, this is important to know. If you work with an EPA RPM, again, it's still good to know what guidelines, I suppose, that we're looking at. So making sure that all applicable federal rules and regulations about community involvement are being implemented appropriately, advocating for that early and meaningful community involvement or engagement, knowing your FFA, making sure that you're making those requirements well known, and beyond that, promoting additional community engagement activities that will meet the needs of your community. And when that's not happening, being a very very vocal, very loud voice on identifying this is not happening as intended for the decision-making process at these sites. The community needs to be given a voice to weigh in. And just making sure again that any requirements in the FFA that go beyond the NCP related to community involvement are being met as well as each decision goes forward. And that's what part of what makes it complicated is our sites are so large for federal facilities. They're broken up into smaller operable units. So you could have dozens, if not hundreds, of decision documents that ultimately are going to be issued for a site. So you're going through the Superfund process again and again for these various OUs and making sure that for each decision, the community has the opportunity to be involved. It is a daunting task, possibly, but nonetheless, we still want to ensure that the community has the opportunity to be involved in that decision-making process, each of them. All right. So we're going to switch gears a little bit here to levels of community involvement. Just talking a bit about the history. Where were we before and where are we now? So I'm going to take us back a little bit, just looking at history and trends of community involvement in Superfund. So in the 1950s, if we go back then, I would say the federal government definitely had this the DAD approach, the decide, announce, and defend. This is what we're going to do, just letting you all know. It's the right thing to do, and that's that. So not a lot of opportunity for engagement or back and forth. This began to change in 1969 with the passage of NEPA, the Na excuse me, National Environmental Policy Act. With that, it was more of an inclusive stakeholder approach to integrate the community, at least start integrating them into this decision-making process. NEPA requires that environmental impact studies be performed for any large federal action, and it includes a process to get comments from the public, those public comment periods. So that was a start. Coming into 1980, with the passage of CERCLA and the decision that, yes, we really should be involving the public in the decision-making process, it got more into a back and forth, this informing the public, listening to what they had to say, and making adjustments to the decision at hand. This was further supported by the SARA, the Superfund amendments in 1986, where it became even more apparent that there was value in providing these opportunities to the public to weigh in and influence decisions. So not just educating the public, but involving them, engaging with them. And that brings us to where we are now with trying to really integrate public participation into the decision-making process. So it's been a long road, but we're here now. As I was just talking about the history of where we were and where we are, there really is a spectrum of community involvement. There is no one size fits all or one right way to do this for our various sites. So what you're seeing on screen right now is adapted from a figure with the International Association of Public Participation. And it really looks at this spectrum of community involvement. What are your outcomes? Like, what is the purpose you're trying to fill? And essentially, what are you saying? When I say you, I mean the site team at conducting the cleanup. What are you trying to give and get from the public? For example, in this first line here, if we're just looking at outreach and you're really just trying to inform in the community of something that's happening, there are situations where informing is fine. Maybe it's not an opportunity for engagement. You're providing an update, or there's going to be a road closure because of cleanup, something like that. So you might get the word out through a website or fact sheets or a press release announcing some whatever it is you have to announce. But if you are looking to engage more with the community, then it could be an information exchange. It could be to take their recommendations into consideration for cleanup. Perhaps it's part of required activities such as a community involvement plan, the interviews for those, or are you actually trying to empower the stakeholders to take some kind of action? We don't typically go quite that far, but I'll highlight here the areas where we do see a lot of activity. That's in information exchange, where the site team, the agencies are essentially promising that we're going to listen, we're going to acknowledge your concerns, and then provide feedback on how those comments, concerns were considered and actually influenced the decision. So it's a back and forth, an information exchange. With recommendations, many of our federal facility sites have advisory boards, be it DOE site-specific advisory boards or remediation advisory boards, but we're going to talk about those in a second with our next section. And actually, I will go ahead and hand it over to Cal to talk about that. And Cal, would you introduce yourself for the group, please?
Hi, sure. I'm Cal Bayer Anderson. I work with EMI in the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, where I touch on environmental justice issues, community involvement, and PFAS. So I'm happy to be here today to talk more about community involvement. So starting with the community advisory boards. So, community advisory boards at federal facilities merit special consideration as DoD and DOE offer the option of forming these community advisory boards that offer local stakeholders opportunities to participate at sites that have both remedial and removal cleanups. So the DoD Restoration Advisory Boards, or RABs, are typically established at a DoD NPL site where there is sufficient and sustained community interest. On the DoE Site-Specific Advisory Boards, or SSABs, they exist at several DoE sites. These boards are comprised of representatives of the lead agency with EPA and state reps participating, but they offer stakeholder groups and concerned citizens who are committed to reviewing site plans to participate in decision making. They may also be eligible to receive technical assistance. So EPA works with DoD and DOE, states and respective stakeholders at the local level by providing technical and regulatory input. Many times the RPM and the community involvement coordinator from EPA are represented at these meetings. Okay, so in 1994, DoD and EPA issued joint guidance on RAB implementation. So RABs are this forum for exchange of information and partnership among citizens, the installation, EPA, states, and local governments. But more importantly, they offer that opportunity for communities to provide input to the cleanup process. It is DoD and EPA's view that the RABs can improve DoD's cleanup program by increasing community understanding and support for the cleanup efforts, improving the soundness of government decisions, and ensuring that those cleanups are responsive to community needs. Ideally, RABs bring together people who reflect the diverse interests within the local community, enabling the early and continued flow of information throughout the process between the affected community, DoD, and the regulators. So DoD is creating RABs to ensure that all stakeholders have a voice and can actively participate in timely and in a thorough manner in the review of restoration documents. So it is quite intensive in terms of a commitment to meeting regularly and reviewing documents and providing feedback. As a forum, it is important to allow for the expression of diverse points of view. So you bring that together out in the open. The RAB complements other community involvement efforts, but does not replace them. And we're going to touch on this in a few minutes. The DoD sorry, the DoD installation will continue to be responsible for fulfilling the statutory mandated public involvement requirements. And we'll go over that in a little bit too. In May of 2006, the RAB rule was issued in the Federal Register, followed by the issuance of a RAB rule handbook. And this was a big deal for community members because this provides more specific information on the use and operation of RABs explains the expectations for participation and organization. And it also involved a lot of input from impacted communities. Now on the DOE side, the DOE Environmental Management Program established the site-specific advisory boards back in 1994. And again, you know, like the DOD RABs, the idea is to involve stakeholders more directly in the cleanup decisions. Currently, there are 8 local boards around the DOE EM complex, and the links on the slide are hyperlinks, so it could take you to their SSAB sites. So the SSABs are a little different. They're governed by the Federal Advisory Committee Act, or FACA, which was enacted to ensure that the government board deliberations are open and transparent to the public. Members of the EMSSAB are made of representatives of the community around DOE sites and not necessarily experts. But the FACA really formalizes the advisory board process. It requires all meetings to be open and accessible to the public. Meetings must be announced in the Federal Register. All documents must be maintained for the life of the board. Members represent diverse interests, and there be time allotted at each meeting for additional public comment. So DOE is required to formally respond to each recommendation made by a local board. And all of the local boards have both state and EPA liaisons. And while the state and EPA are not voting members of these boards, they should be allotted time to speak at any of the meetings if requested. Overall, though, the SSABs, because they're FACA, they're governed under FACA, they have more structure to them than the RABs. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, just because you have a RAB or SSAB, that doesn't mean you don't have to do anything else for community involvement. Certainly you do. The boards have limitations. They often represent that small group of active stakeholders while they provide useful recommendations to the federal agency. Working to involve the broader community affected by cleanup decisions being made is also necessary. And, you know, some communities are not interested in forming an advisory board or being on the board, but they still want information and they still might have feedback and opinions. So you need to find these other ways to engage with the community in addition to the advisory boards. So recently we've gotten feedback. The Navy has been holding community information sessions at a variety of locations in Virginia, and they've received very positive feedback from impacted communities. It works for those communities. In other cases, you might have to do the door-to-door canvassing or mailers or social media, but really the bottom line is you have to match your engagement strategies with the needs of the community and their preferences. With that, I turn it back to Emmy.
Thank you, Cal. So one thing I wanted to show you all as far as how to explain the Superfund process to others, on our website for the Federal Facilities Program at EPA, we've added this webpage that's for the Federal Facilities cleanup process. So it's still Superfund, it's still CERCLA, but it really gets into where the community involvement opportunities are through each step of the process. So we're going to actually visit this web page briefly so I can show you what it looks like. So we clicked there, and there's a link to this in the participant manual again. So we'll scroll down here to try to make it a tool that the public could use as well to better understand how a federal facility goes through the Superfund process, from the docket listing, which we have here, which is specific to federal facilities, and then site assessment to listing on the NPL, and all the way through the CERCLA process. So I'm going to click on this first, or this second step, I should say, site assessment. So you can see we have more information on site assessment, but in trying to speak to the public, we added a box, call out box here that says, why should I care about site assessment? Trying to put it in a perspective that the average person could see the value in being more engaged in this step of the process. And then we also identify the community involvement call out box here that specifically identifies these are the opportunities you'll have or the activities that should be held at this point in the process. So we went through and added this background information to folks who are interested in learning more. And we actually provide statistics that are pulled from our databases. It's a little slow in loading here, but we provide a very easy to understand explanation of what this number represents. So here, the number of federal facility sites where a preliminary assessment is happening, that number will pop up, and so on. So we're trying to provide them background, current information, awareness on where they can be involved. So we're excited that this could be a tool or an example to other groups who are trying to communicate with their communities. All right, then we're going to go ahead and go back to the slides and transition to our case study. And Laura, I know you're coming online. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Hi. Yes. Hello, everyone. And thank you so much for being on this webinar today. I'm excited to be here. My name is Laura Knudsen, and I am a senior community involvement coordinator in EPA out of our Region 10 office, which is based in Seattle. And I've had some experience working on Superfund federal facility sites. So I was asked to briefly share some of my experience on federal facilities and community involvement with all of you today. And so for today's case study, which I'll be changing the slide in just a second to give you some more information, I am going to focus on one site in particular, which is the Fairchild Air Force Base Superfund site in Spokane, Washington, which is in Eastern Washington. And because of that, I would also like to introduce who's on today too as a panelist, our lead EPA remedial project manager for Fairchild, Jacqueline Satira. And Jacqueline, you want to come on camera just to say hi, but you don't have to. And Jacqueline may add some pieces during this case study as well. So just wanted to mention that. There's Jacqueline. Hey, Jacqueline. So moving on to our next slide, 1 second. Awesome. So Fairchild Air Force Base, this just gives you some general overview of the site first. So it was located in Spokane, as I said, Washington, and was listed as a Superfund site on the National Priorities List by EPA in March of 1989. So it's been there a while. And the site includes 4 waste areas covering 85 acres. And Jacqueline and I will show a map on the next slide of that in a moment. But some other background, past activities and waste disposal practices did contaminate the groundwater, soil, and sediment with hazardous chemicals. And remedial action or construction of the cleanup, the final cleanup, has been completed or is underway at some site areas or operable units is a word you might hear too, some specific areas designated for cleanup. And remedial design, which is the Air Force is working under EPA oversight to design the final cleanup, is underway for the remaining operable units. And the Air Force, the reason why I wanted to select this specific case study is because of a specific issue that comes up at Fairchild, and I think a lot of, well, I know a lot of federal facility sites across the country, and that is that the Air Force, and this is not unique to the Air Force, began using legacy aqueous film forming foam, or AFFF, in the 1970s as a firefighting agent to extinguish petroleum fires. And AFFF was used extensively at Fairchild Air Force Base, but not just there, it was around, used around the United States and the world as well from the 1970s until 2016 in Fairchild's case to fight petroleum fires. So unfortunately, as many of you probably know, and if you don't know, then we'll say it right now, is that AFFF does include per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, which is also known as PFAS, P-F-A-S is what it's called for short. And that's a group of man-made chemicals. An exposure to some PFAS in the environment may be linked to harmful health effects in humans and animals. And so I'm going to go to the next slide. Just these photos on the slide were just to kind of give you some background on what the Air Force Base looks like and some of the past practices. So this is a slide I'll be talking about the map in just a second, because there's a couple of things on it in addition to Fairchild. So additionally, there are two compounds of PFAS in the PFAS family that dissolve really easily in water and can travel with groundwater. And so as a result, the Fairchild Air Force Base is investigating PFAS in groundwater and monitoring some off-site drinking water wells. And Fairchild Air Force Base provides in-home treatment or alternative water to homes that exceed the EPA's 2016 PFAS health advisory, which if you didn't know that's, you know, from 2016. So we have since, there's updated information, but they're using the 2016 number of 70 parts per trillion. And as of 2023, the Air Force has taken 427 samples from private wells and provided alternative water to 107 residents. And so this is the topic that we're focusing on for the case study, because this slide here also shows you that in addition to the Fairchild Air Force Base, which is on the left here, it's located right next to the city of Airway Heights, which is kind of that blue. I don't know if you want to point Jean a little bit. The blue in the middle, thank you, is the city of Airway Heights. And then to the right, there's the Spokane Airport. And that has been identified as another source, a separate source of PFAS. But community members right in the area have concerns about this entire area, even though Fairchild Air Force Base, you know, is a separate source from the Spokane Airport. And so while the Air Force began replacing both, you know, legacy AFFF products and some of those PFAS-based products with new environmentally responsible formula in August of 2016, and they completed that new delivery in August 2017, there's, you know, concern from community members on exposure to PFAS in their drinking water from both the Fairchild Air Force Base and the Spokane Airport remains really high and poses really complicated communication opportunities, I'm saying opportunities, as well as community involvement opportunities and work. And so that is why we have the case study. And so a couple of things, and I'll talk about this picture in a second. So as Jacqueline and I have been working, you know, and delving, and Jacqueline's done an amazing job, you know, Emmy was saying to be that voice, be proactive. Jacqueline does an amazing job of that and really, you know, connecting with community members too. But as we, you know, kind of work together to delve into community involvement concerns more, there are two kind of key pieces or takeaways for this case study before we take any questions that you might have for us that we wanted to highlight. And so the first takeaway is something that you'll be talking about after this case study, which, but Emmy hit on it already, is some of the CI community involvement requirements in the National Contingency Plan and CERCLA. So one takeaway is it's always good to take another look, a fresh look maybe even if a site has been listed since 1989, like Fairchild, to see if all the community involvement requirements are in place and follow up if they're not. So this is a a case study where that has been applied, because as Jacqueline and I did discuss community concerns about the site together, and then, you know, with community members too, such as, you know, there's some discontent at Fairchild, which is pretty well known by everyone, about the Restoration Advisory Board, what Cal was just talking about, you know, the structure, the meeting frequency, being responsive to community concerns, particularly regarding the PFAS issue, which I just outlined. So I asked what the community involvement plan for Fairchild entailed, and Jacqueline and I quickly realized that while a limited community involvement plan for a previous removal action existed, a full community involvement plan for the entire site was not yet in place. And so that we you know, talked about that, and you'll learn in just a moment, if you don't already, that the National Contingency Plan also requires a community involvement plan for removal actions lasting longer than 6 months. And that includes the PFAS testing at Fairchild that we just talked about on the previous slide. And so Jacqueline, as a result, was able to elevate this issue because of that NCP requirement and discuss with the Air Force this topic. And now a community involvement plan is being developed, and community interviews are being conducted. So that's one takeaway. You know, again, always good to take another look about all the CI requirements, follow up. And secondly, I would say the other takeaway, the second one, is to use in-person interaction and relationship building to provide more robust community involvement guidance and support. And like Emmy was saying, you know, if you're on this webinar, and you are an EPA person or part of a team, or you're, you know, a member of the public, having an EPA and community involvement coordinator involved when possible at these sites is helpful, because we have a lot of experience and a lot of tools and resources, like Emily was saying, with community involvement that we can help provide to the federal facilities. So this photo here was taken at the February 2024 open house at Fairchild, which occurred after the Restoration Advisory Board meeting. And I was able to actually meet with the contractors that have now been assigned, you know, and contracted by the Air Force who are working on the community involvement plan. This is their poster, actually, and connect them with interested community members who Jacqueline and I are working with to build relationships with, and provide guidance kind of on the spot to that contracting team and continue to work with them. I was able to build those relationships to help provide guidance, like suggest not solely relying on form surveys to collect information for the CIP, which was, I think, something they had already thought about doing, was additional, you know, interviews, but really highlighting that in-person interviews, especially for this high interest site and topics, is important. And so they're planning, you know, to do that more, I know, from our discussions. And then also suggesting, you know, an EPA best practice, which you can see on this slide, that they have prepared community involvement plan, but they don't have like a feedback loop on how folks, you know, or people who provide input on the draft CIP, how that will be, how that feedback loop will occur. So just suggesting that an EPA best practice is to circle back with people before you finalize the CIP, to tell them and show them in the CIP where their feedback was incorporated. So suggesting that, and then also reminding them that EPA, we are going to be reviewing and approving the final community involvement plan, and that I'm here and Jacqueline's here as a resource. And lastly, this in-person piece was important because we found out too, a lot of community members who are really engaged and interested did not know about a community involvement plan, didn't know that it's, you know, a requirement by the law, didn't know like what it is, that there includes an action plan in it, which Emmy will talk about, that has specific actions, you know, that are being committed to for involving community members, and getting information to them. And so I also encourage them to provide interviews for the community involvement plan as well. So with that, I will stop and I will open it up to any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so very much, Laura. I'm going to take a few questions that have come into the Q&A for you. And at this time, I'm going to go ahead and add Emmy in on the spotlight too, just in case she can assist. But this first question is regarding the RABs. Has there been a study on the efficacy of these RABs?
Laura, did you want to speak to what you've seen under the PFAS, the DoD PFAS task force, on that effort?
Yeah, sure. And Jacqueline, do you want to talk about it a little bit first too? Just because I know you were kind of connected more. I can say, but I want to give you the space first if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I think the DoD has assigned the Department of Defense. They are working on improving community involvement. They're providing additional support to the various sites in order to improve the RAB and some more technical knowledge. I think previously, before PFAS, a lot of federal facility work was kind of moving along very smoothly, or not very smoothly, but smoothly. And so the PFAS has provided an additional challenge. And so the DoD is trying to support their federal facility members.
So we have seen just off of that they, you know, have come that task force to the Fairchild Restoration Advisory Board last month, and then have, I know, at least from my experience, also the Whidbey Island Naval Base have come there too to kind of see how community involvement is working in those spaces. And I think they're planning to provide some and develop some tools and also reference kind of existing tools like EPA's tools that we put the link in the chat for kind of all the, you know, the federal family and Department of Defense agencies. So.
Right. Excellent. We had another question about RABs. One of the attendees is just commenting on some challenges that they had in getting the word out and having community members understand their ability to participate in a RAB. And they're just curious how many community members are needed to establish a RAB.
So I had to pull up the 2007 RAB handbook to look at the specifics on what criteria are needed to establish a RAB. And in that document, it states that at least 50 local citizens need to have petitioned for a RAB. The installation, has determined the need for a RAB, or the federal, state, tribal, or local government representatives have requested a RAB. So it seems like there's a number of ways where that criteria could be met. I would recommend looking at the 2007 handbook for more of the specifics.
All right, excellent. And then just quickly about community involvement plans. Does the NTP mention a timeframe to establish a CIP?
So I was also double checking our Superfund community involvement handbook. And I know, you know, it's supposed to be, I wanted to actually cite exactly what it says in there. But Emmy, if you want to jump in first, because if you go to the handbook, Appendix A is the one that I like to use that one the most. And it has, because it actually has the NCP requirements cited. And so I was just double checking on there so I can give you the best answer possible. So there's a couple, there are two pieces to this, and the first piece is when you first create it, and that's a good point about the looking at the 2026 or I think you said 2026. Oh, that it won't be issued till 2026. Okay. So the community involvement plan piece, so it's really supposed to be started prior. You're kind of supposed to start doing it once it's listed on the national priorities list. That's when the community involvement plan, it says actually like in the NCP, that's when you start to prepare. They call it a community relations plan in the NCP, but that's when it's really supposed to start being prepared. Mm-hmm. And so that's the goal. And then it is, you know, after record of decision or final cleanup plan is prepared, there's a provision also that says that's a good time to revisit the community involvement plan and see if there's any updates. And so that's also in there.
Yeah, part of the challenges as far as updating a community involvement plan, there is no what I would call hard requirement. There's no every 5 years thou shall conduct this review. So you get into this gray space of working with your site partners and the lead agency to make sure that document is up to date, especially when cleanups can last decades at our federal facility sites.
Okay. All right, I am looking at the clock. It is 1:49, and we have lots of slides to go through. So, although there are just a handful of other questions, I think we're going to carry on with the presentation, but we will pause again later on. So, I want to thank Laura and Jacqueline for joining us today. And, Emmy, I'll turn the floor back to you to carry on with the presentation.
All right, thank you. And thank you to Laura and Jacqueline for sharing that site-specific case information with us. That's always really helpful. But we're going to come back to the NPL listing process now and look at how community involvement is needed there. So when you're at the very beginning of the Superfund process and looking at siting a facility on the docket, really at that stage, you're assessing whether or not that site should, after conducting a preliminary assessment, potentially a site inspection, you're trying to determine if there is sufficient risk or hazard posed by that site to merit the site being listed on the national priorities list. So in that process, there aren't many hard requirements for community involvement, but it is a great opportunity for the site team to start getting to know the community in the event that it in fact does move forward to be proposed for listing on the NPL. So for federal facilities, as you can see on screen, we go through that dock and listing, CERCLIS, now SEMS, is where we're tracking that. And when conducting the preliminary assessment, it may be determined, oh, there's no further Superfund action needed at this site. So no further action, or that site might be referred to another cleanup program for potential cleanup. Once the PA is conducted, site inspection may be suggested or recommended to be completed, so you can do that hazard ranking and then determine what the if it scores high enough to be considered for placement on the NPL. So granted, not a lot of specific community involvement requirements, but it's still a great chance to learn about the demographics, characteristics, potential concerns of the community as you're beginning to learn more about the site. There are a few things that are required once you get to that point of this site is going to be listed on the NPL. So community involvement at that point requires you to publish a proposed rule in the Federal Register to add that site to the NPL. And that goes through a public comment process. It has to be at least 30 days long. And once those comments are received, EPA needs to prepare and publish a response to comments to address any significant comments that are received or any new information that comes to light. Again, this is an EPA process. Even for federal facilities, the lead agency, if it's going to be DOD or DOE, whichever federal agency, EPA handles the NPL. And I know there's been some confusion over that, but EPA will be holding the public comment period, drafting that response to comments, and ultimately, if the decision is to move forward, publishing a final rule for the NPL listing in the Federal Register where the site is officially put on the NPL. We have some sites that are proposed and never made it to final listing. They've been in this proposed status for decades. So just something to keep in mind. On this slide, we've taken something or a figure from that community involvement handbook I mentioned. And I like this because it very quickly summarizes by the asterisk activities that are required under CERCLA, non-optional, things that have to be done. But it also identifies if you have a community that has a moderate level of interest or perhaps a very high level of interest, there's additional activities you could consider conducting to engage with the community at your sites. So some things listed here as far as moderate level of interest, perhaps you want to issue additional information in the form of fact sheets or a technical paper, whatever makes sense for the community. Or do you need to set up some social media or a website that has short videos and, you know, easier delivery of the information to inform the public across the spectrum of ages of folks that might be participating, realizing that social media use is a growing way, if not for younger generations, the primary way they get their information. So that is one avenue you could pursue. If there's really a high level of interest and that person-to-person engagement, face-to-face engagement is being recommended, hosting an open house or other type of workshop to talk about the Superfund process or talk about the site. So again, these are specific to the MPL listing phase for the different levels of interest and suggested activities that could be done. We're going to switch gears now to removal action community involvement, because there are requirements for removal actions as well. So we have three types of removal actions. You have your emergency response. So typically, action is needed now. There's an emergency that has to be addressed now. Or typically, action is taken within hours. So you can imagine in a situation like that, there may not be any time to do paperwork like writing an action memo. And an action memo is the primary document that is used for removal actions to identify what the risks are and what action is being taken to address those risks for the re emergency removal. So, emergency response, probably don't have time to do an action memo. For a time critical removal action, sometimes you'll hear these referred to as TCRAs. Action is required within 6 months, so a relatively short time frame. And typically, you will have an approved action memo in place before initiating the action, so you know what the decision is moving forward. For non-time critical removal actions, the planning period is typically more than 6 months. You have much more time available. And for those types of actions, there are additional requirements, such as issuing an engineering evaluation cost analysis or ECA for public comment. And then, once considering public comment, moving forward with developing and signing that action memo. So that's a big list of items, keeping in mind that each type has different levels of community involvement requirements, but there are some that are the same for all. So, with your basic community involvement actions for all removals, there is requirements as listed in the NCP to designate an agency spokesperson. So you can imagine that makes sense when you have a new site, the press or other community groups want to know who to go to get information. So you'll have an agency spokesperson after the site is established. That might be an Office of Public Affairs or Public Relations for the lead agency. You have to establish an administrative record and inform the community about that administrative record through some kind of notification process. When you have time critical responses that are in that less than 6 months planning period, you also need to have a public comment period within 30 days of the administrative record file being made available to the public. And that way, the public can provide their comments on the action, their concerns. Anything related to the site, essentially. And that again will require a response to comments from the lead agency in working as well with the regulatory agencies. Looking at those time critical responses that last more than 120 days, there are additional requirements of conducting community interviews, issuing that community involvement plan. So if you're in a removal action, and you're past that 120-day mark, and there's no community involvement plan for that site or for that action, it has to be issued. And also establishing an information repository where people can physically go to access files. With non-time critical responses that have that longer planning period, the 6 months, I mentioned already issuing that ECA for public comment, a public comment period of at least 30 days. And that can be extended by 15 days upon timely request from a commenter. And then the responsiveness summary that will come from that public comment effort needs to be added to the administrative record. These are all requirements of the lead agency, but EPA, as a federal regulator, should also be ensuring that all of these requirements are met. Under Executive Order 12580, the authority for conducting removal actions at a number of federal facility sites, it falls to the lead agency. So sometimes the regulators have less of a role. That's not true for all federal facility sites, but for many, the regulators may have less of a review or oversight role, but despite that, the lead agency has to comply with these requirements in the NCP because they're required under CERCLA. And there we go. Okay, on this graphic, I like it. So everything I told you in a lot of text and a lot of slides is very neatly put into this table here. I really like this chart because it check marks, all right, if you're in this situation, these are the activities that you have to conduct for this removal action. So great resource. If you deal with a lot of removal actions, I would print out this one slide and just have it there for easy reference, so you know you're not dropping the ball on a requirement that has to be met. All right, so now we have a few polls for our participants. Jean, will you lead us through these?
I would be happy to. So at this time, we're going to do a quick knowledge check with everyone. So I'm going to launch a series of polls one at a time here on the screen. Our first question should be popping up right now in a new window where we're asking you to identify if this statement is either true or false. A removal is time critical when a site evaluation has been conducted and it is determined that there is not an immediate emergency, but an on-site removal activity must begin within 6 months. Is that statement true or false? On that pop-up window, you'll see a button or circle to the left of either true or false. Simply click that and then hit the submit button. If for any reason you can't see the poll on the screen, you're welcome to simply send your response in as a message through the Q&A space. I see many of you are indicating your responses. We want to go through these questions pretty quickly for time purposes. So about half of you have responded. Remember, we're not going to grade you, so you can take your best guess and then hit submit. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll down in 3, 2, 1. And let's look at those results. So, Emmy, it looks like the audience was somewhat split. About 2/3 said true and about 1/3 said false. What's the right answer in this case?
In this case, it would be a time critical removal action.
All right. So that particular statement is, as I'm scrolling, true. Excellent. All right. So I'm going to stop sharing this and let's move on to our next poll. So I'm going to pop up a new window now. And our second question for you. What two community involvement or CI activities are required when a removal action on-site activity takes less than 120 days? So you can check off multiple responses here. So there'll be a box next on the left of each. So is it complete a CI plan, establish an administrative record, notify the public about the availability of the administrative record, establish an information repository, or conduct community interviews? So just check off the boxes to the left of what you think are the two CI activities that are required when a removal action on-site activity takes less than 120 days, and then hit the submit button. That looks like about 1/3 of you have shared your responses. So I'll go ask you to go with your gut, click those two, and then hit submit. And then I'll close this poll down in 3, 2, 1. And looking at these results, there's a bit of a distribution, but it looks like the largest percentage of you picked establish an administrative record, about 2/3 of you picked that. And then about half of you said notify the public about the availability of that AR. And then the about half felt establishing an information repository. So they picked B, C, and D. Emmy, the right answers are?
B and C. Establishing the administrative record and notifying the public about it.
All right, excellent. So let's ask one more question while we've got you there. And this time a new window has popped up, but this time we are asking a slightly different question. So now we're asking, what activities are required when a removal action on-site activity takes more than 120 days. Again, check off the two by clicking on that box to the left. Is it complete a communications plan, establish an administrative record, notify the public about the availability of the AR, establish an information repository, or conduct community interviews? Again, take your best guess. This is in a situation where your removal action on-site activity is taking more than 120 days. Looks like about half of you have sent your responses in. So I'll go ahead and give you just a few more seconds here to hit your boxes and then hit submit. Let me close the poll down in 3, 2, 1. All right. And now in this case, It looked like three quarters of you said complete a communications plan, and then about two thirds of you said establish an information repository. Emmy, for this one, the correct answers are.
So we were looking for B, C, D, and E as far as what's required versus what would be recommended.
All right. And now let's take a look at our last question. So I'm going to stop this one and we're going to go back and we are going to launch one more poll. So moving forward to our last question here. Now, what activities are required for a non-time critical removal action with a planning period of more than 6 months? Again, you'll see those same options. Respond to public comment, pardon me, not the same options, but you'll see those five options below. Respond to public comments in a responsiveness summary, establish an administrative record, hold a public meeting, hold a public comment period, and then conduct community interviews. So you can check off any of the activities that you think are required for those non-time critical removal actions when you have a planning period of more than 6 months and then hit submit. I'm looking at about a third of you having cast your responses. So I'll give you just a few more seconds to take your best guess and then hit submit. And I'll go ahead and close this poll down in 3, 2, 1. And Emmy, in this case, it's again looks like there's a bit of a spread on the answers.
Right.
It looks like hold a public comment period, establishing an administrative record, and respond to public comments in a responsiveness summary. So A, B, and D were the top responses. What's the right answer in this case?
So A, B, and D are correct, as well as E, conduct community interviews. The only one not required is the requirement to hold a public meeting.
All right, excellent. All right, I think we're going to stop sharing those and we will carry on with our presentation. So I'm going to put the floor back to you, Emmy. Go right ahead.
We're going to switch into environmental justice considerations with Cal for our next section.
All right, Cal, let's turn the floor over to you.
All right, thanks. Environmental justice is not a new topic within EPA. We ha actually have a long history of addressing environmental justice considerations, particularly within community outreach and engagement. But in April 2021, the administrator directed all EPA offices to basically up our game. And do more to integrate environmental justice considerations into all of our work. So, in his message, the administrator called on EPA to change how we do business. And I highlighted two of the requests here. Number one, take immediate and affirmative steps to incorporate environmental justice considerations into our work, including assessing impacts to pollution burden, underserved and tribal communities. Also, to take immediate and affirmative steps to improve early and more frequent engagement with pollution burden in underserved communities. So, as I said, I think Superfund, the second one, is really not that new to us. When dealing with federal facilities cleanups under CERCLA, as Emmy mentioned earlier, we have the opportunity and actually the responsibility through regulatory oversight to ensure that the potential for disproportionate impacts is identified so that vulnerabilities and exposure conditions can be accounted for, assessed, and addressed. So EPA RPMs should review the lead agency's community involvement plan and get help from your community involvement coordinator, if they are available to help you. We can request updates and oversee implementation to ensure that the community engagement is meaningful and effective. Okay, so what's clear from the administrator's directive is that environmental justice is about providing the same degree of protection and ensuring meaningful engagement. So it's about both, right? So when reviewing and commenting on other federal agencies' engagement strategy, we can keep in mind that although current guidance is not prescriptive at all, there are a number of tools that we can use to help us identify factors that may suggest potential environmental justice concerns. And we can conduct these screening level analyses to look at, say, social and economic conditions, access to healthcare and disease burden, the proximity to site-specific sources and releases. And remember that the federal facilities can be like super large. So there may be a community to the Northwest may be exposed to very different kind of array of contaminants than a community to the Southeast. And they may be totally different communities in terms of composition, interest, at socioeconomic level, et cetera. So there's, you know, it's a lot more, it can be a lot more complicated at federal facility sites. We can also consider the presence of additional sources and releases of contaminants that may be impacting the population. It may not be directly related to the CERCLA action, but it can prompt us to engage with other partners to help the communities address their needs. So, but these combinations of various stressors occurring in conjunction with one another within a single community can be an important red flag. As we mentioned previously, screening is one thing. It's a good thing to do. It can be very helpful to develop a more effective outreach strategy. There's no substitute for that direct community engagement, where you may learn directly from the communities how they come into contact with the contaminants. Is it through residential scenarios, backyard gardening, subsistence fishing, recreating, etc.? And learning about that is really, really important to understand potential exposure scenarios. Engaging directly with the public, you could also learn about site-specific community concerns, what they perceive to be the biggest issues. And they may actually have some knowledge about the history of the facility that others don't have just because they've been living there for so long. So screening and outreach can help identify impacts and start to think about potential intervention points and courses of action that you can take. And we would argue that considering environmental justice is important throughout the circle of process. And you know, this helps us ensure that the any remedy decisions we make actually reflect any community and environmental justice concerns, particularly for people of color, low-income populations, and indigenous populations. And as we also mentioned, ideally, the screening starts at the outset of the project with the development of the community involvement plan. But throughout the process of scoping and investigation, there are multiple opportunities to consider what are often referred to as the receptors, the community, and make sure that the community and their needs are centered in the process. For example, like when you're scoping a remedial investigation, DOD or DOE or other federal agencies will need to complete a quality assurance plan. This has a section describing receptors, receptors meaning the communities, right? And so there's an opportunity to build out the description of the community characteristics and identify vulnerabilities here. And this can also be a place where we can capture these exposure scenarios that might be unique to those communities. And then this information further, you know, can be carried throughout the investigation and into as incorporated into the risk assessment itself and become that foundation for the decision-making process. So what I think I'm trying to emphasize is that it's not just a checklist, it's just not something that you do at the beginning, but it should be woven into your process. You should be thinking about the community. They should be the center. We're protecting their health. They should be at the center of the investigation and not just you know, a sidebar. And also at the end, during 5-year reviews, which I'll talk about a little later, there's another opportunity to ask the question, has the community changed over the past 5 years? Has there been turnover? Are there now more people who speak a different language that might be present in the community that you need to account for? So, this is not an extra. This is really rooted in best practices in understanding community and developing meaningful outreach. Okay. So, it's not enough to know to do the screening and know about what burdens and vulnerabilities are present in the community. It's like how you use this information to strategize how you can engage with the community or communities. For example, based on screening tools, we may learn of a substantial Spanish-speaking population. So we should be prepared in our outreach to include Spanish language translations. And knowing this upfront can help us be more effective right at the outset. There are a lot of stressors that may be present that fall outside of CERCLA. And this is a tougher issue that we often have to deal with. So, one strategy that has become that's being used throughout Superfund is to convene other agencies, state or local agencies, other parts of EPA even, to help address community concerns. Like through that community engagement, you might learn about concerns regarding highway traffic and pollution, for example, not a CERCLA issue. But if we can invite someone from the state highway department, for example, to a meeting with people, we can help connect them so that they can be heard. Okay, sorry. Next slide. So then there's the issue of protection, right? We need to figure out how to use the information we are learning from the community to improve how they are protected by the CERCLA actions. So, for example, we may learn from outreach that there is an avid fishing community close to the known contamination. We can use this information to refine our conceptual site model, make sure that exposure to contaminants via fishing is incorporated into the risk assessment, and we collect the samples appropriate to assess risk. So that we could take action if needed. If there are non-site related factors, again, this is the harder part. It's like not CERCLA, but it can be very useful for decision makers to understand the nature of the community, the conditions that they're living in, whether it's extreme poverty or food deserts, et cetera. This isn't something that we quantitatively evaluate, but we can include it in a qualitative description of the community so that we make it clear that there are other stressors that may be present and rendering that community more vulnerable to chemical exposures that are connected to the site. Again, don't think about it necessarily. We have to quantify everything and everything has to be included in an equation, but rather kind of qualitatively understanding the community's lived experience can be very powerful. Okay, so then a word about documentation. Ultimately, we recommend that you find ways to document your work in considering environmental justice throughout the CERCLA process. And include that in any other vulnerabilities in your documentation or in DOD's documentation or DOE's documentation. We can be kind of the squeaky wheel that continues to encourage them to incorporate this information into your documents. This could include site-specific assessment of environmental justice concerns. It could be the absence of environmental justice concerns. We did our due diligence, And, we're not seeing disproportionate impacts in this community. It's important to nail that down. If there are vulnerable populations, like I said, there are many opportunities in the documentation to capture this, as well as any of the activities such as outreach and engagement, the risk assessment considerations, inputs, qualitative considerations of community concerns. And all of this comes together with revenue selection and effectiveness, right? So the advantage of doing this, it takes a little bit more work, but it will promote consistency. It helps share best practices. We believe it will lead to better, more effective cleanups. And often it supports required reporting, because I do want to note that it's not just EPA that has been put on notice. DOD, DOE, all federal agencies are required to better incorporate environmental justice considerations into their work. And often there's requirements for reporting up the chain. And so by working this together, we can kind of help each other document our work and meet the responsibilities of our organizations. On this last slide for environmental justice, I want to talk about a pilot project that we did in EPA Region 3. So this was not a community involvement project per se. Rather, it was to develop a systematic approach to incorporating EJ considerations into the CERCLA process at federal facilities. And so what we did was this, as I said, this came out of EPA Region 3, and they recruited three federal facilities: an Army base in Pennsylvania, an Air Force base in Delaware, and a Navy base in Virginia. And the state representatives on each of these sites were also involved, as were EPA Region 3 people and then staff from our federal facilities office. So it was DoD, states, and EPA all working together. And there were no presumptions. We weren't like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We went into it saying, we're going to figure this out. We're going to use tools. We're going to strategize based on the information that we get out of that, how we can refine our community outreach and start to plan on what we might be able to do about this. And so the subject of our first year report out was really kind of outlining this framework for bringing environmental justice considerations into the process. And this year now, and this year they've been out there trying out new community outreach and engagement strategies. And so hopefully this summer we'll have a report out of year two. What we've also done through this is start to prepare guides, which are available on our website, as is the first year report. The website is on the slide. And these guides are intended to kind of highlight parts of the process where to bring together recommendations, tools, suggestions for what you might want to try at your site. And so right now we have just two guides in the toolbox, but we have several others in the works. And so check back frequently and we'll be able to hopefully we'll be able to build this out. And I think with that, back to Emmy.
Thank you so much, Cal. We know EJ is just growing in interest, and there's so much we can do. So thank you for sharing those tools and providing that information. Now we're going to get back into the Superfund pipeline and talk about community involvement during remedial actions. So when it comes to remedial actions, some requirements exist before remedial investigation field activities even start. That includes conducting community interviews, preparing your community involvement plan for the site, establishing that local information repository. We talked about some of this already specific to removal actions, but now we're talking about remedial actions. So you still need to establish that administrative record file and make it available as part of the information repository. And also, there is a requirement to publish a notice in the paper of major circulation or use one of the other mechanisms available to give adequate notice. Apologies for my camera there. I think it was freezing a little bit, but let's continue. So, when it comes to public notice, there are specific activities that need to be circulated in a newspaper. And I know not as many folks are using newspapers as before, as compared to electronic options like websites or email, newsletters, things like that. But because it's a requirement in the NCP, there are instances when that notice has to be put in the newspaper, and those are listed here. These were in the next slide. I'm going to talk about where there's more options outside of the newspaper, but for a proposed listing on the NPL, the availability of an administrative record of the proposed plan or issuance of a ROD or ESD, we'll talk more about those in just a second, or when a proposed plan for a ROD amendment is issued, that record of decision. Those specifically state that a notice has to be put in the newspaper. So good to know that. Let's go ahead and look at when you can conduct a public notice by other mechanisms. So that might be if you're talking or trying to notify the public about the availability of administrative record files pertaining to a time critical action. Right, you want to get the word out there quicker. You could use other options, be it email, listserv, telephone calls, posting on a website, things like that. The availability of an ECA for a non-time critical removal action when a site is being deleted from the national priorities list. The availability of the administrative record at the beginning of a remedial investigation. Or for an ECA for a non-time critical removal action for public comment. You can do that by other mechanisms outside of a newspaper or notification of the administrative record for all other removal actions that are not specifically called out in the section identified on the slide there. So there's some flexibility. Those flexibilities came from an effort in 2015 to acknowledge that there are other ways to provide public notice to the community. But again, that list that we had on the previous slide is not subject to this additional flexibility. If you do not put that notice in a newspaper of major circulation, a print paper, you could potentially be at risk for someone from the community to reach out and say, you are not following the decision-making process appropriately. This is a requirement. You need to go back and restart your public comment period. Or you need to go back and hold this public meeting, what have you. So you don't want to be in a spot where you're not meeting the requirements that are identified in the NCP. So that's why we stress them so hard here. All right, so going past public notice, we have again our figure looking at recommended activities, be it at low, moderate, or high levels of interest from the community. The asterisk are for those that are required activities. But if you have moderate interest, then again, you can do those additional activities, all with the intent of providing meaningful community involvement and engaging the community in the decision-making process. So, what's going to help with that? If the community is interested, sharing fact sheets, conducting additional outreach, perhaps on really technical topics that are hard to understand, like risk assessment or other processes that are followed in the site characterization. Just it depends on the needs of the community, what they need to be more involved. And if it's a really high level of interest, then again, supporting that development of a community advisory group, be it through the RABs or the SSABs or another type of community group if it's not a DoD or DoE site. All right, continuing with remedial actions. What are the requirements when you're issuing a proposed plan and a record of decision? So when you're getting ready, you've put all this work, years perhaps of work, to get to a proposed plan that's ready to go out for public comment. At that point, when the document is issued, you have to publish a public notice in the newspaper. make sure that the proposed plan and its supporting information are available to the public, typically through the administrative record and at the information repository. I will say, I had inherited a project where we were about to go to public comment on a proposed plan. One of the major documents that supports your proposed plan is your remedial investigation and feasibility study, the RIFS, associated with that decision. For, in my case, that document actually had not been entered into the administrative record when we started our public comment period. Someone from the public tried to access that record, could not find it, and then came back to us and said, hey, this very important document is not in your administrative record, and you need to restart your public comment period because not all of the supporting information was available. So I learned the hard way to make sure those records are there and available. Hopefully you all don't have to learn the hard way as well. Because again, we had to restart our public comment period because the information was not out there. Other requirements: providing a 30-day public comment period on the proposed plan. And if you read the NCP, it specifically says you can extend the period by at least 30 days if appropriate. I've seen at some sites where they say, oh, we're just going to extend it 5 days, or we're just going to extend it 10 days to give a little more time. Well, the NCP says at least 30 days. So if you do less than that, are you not following the NCP? I'd say there's an argument that could be made there where you would have to maybe go back and restart if someone from the community pointed out that error. So I say if you're going to extend it by at least 30 days. Which is in step with the NCP. One other item, just think to yourself for a second, how many times have you heard, oh, you have to have a public meeting for this proposed plan? I know we can't raise hands, but thinking about that, some of you have probably heard that before. If you read the language in the NCP, it actually says that you must provide the opportunity for a public meeting during the public comment period at or near the site. So that means, is there significant interest? Have people reached out requesting this meeting? Sometimes your site team knows, like, this is really controversial. We already know people are going to request a meeting. Let's just plan it ahead of time. Send out the information, date, time, place, all of those details so that we're prepared. Sometimes you might not be sure. So you might go into public comment and say something to the effect of, if you are interested in requesting a public meeting, please contact so-and-so by X date. And typically that date is maybe about halfway through the public comment period. In that case, you might have to react quickly to get a meeting set up, but at least you'll have a sense of the level of interest. So if a public meeting is held, please note that a transcript of the meeting needs to be developed and then added to the administrative record so the public can access it. Once all that happens, your public comment period has started, ended, you'll get those public comments. The next requirement as part of your record of decision is to prepare a responsiveness summary. And that is typically the last section in your ROD. And finally, once you get through all that and you get to a signed ROD, there's a requirement to publish a notice of availability of that document, again, in a newspaper. So that's a lot. I mean, those are a list of requirements, but that is a lot of work and effort to get through that entire process. Again, I won't take you through this step by step, but again, here are some recommended activities at that low, moderate, and high level of interest based on what your community needs. All right, I think we're going to have just another check-in with our polls to test your understanding. Jean, can you take us through these?
Absolutely. So, Emmy, bear with me. I am divvying up and double-checking on the order that I have on these questions. Okay, so let me go ahead and launch our very first question. So again, we have a new pop-up that is now on the screen. At a minimum, a 30-day public comment period is required on a proposed plan, and upon timely request, the lead agency will extend the public comment period by a minimum of 30 additional days. Is that a true or false statement? Simply click the circle and then hit submit. Does look like about half of you have cast your votes, so I'm going to go ahead and close it out here. And 3, 2, and 1. And looking at those results, almost everybody picked true. Is that the right answer?
Yes, it
Excellent.
is. Absolutely. Thank you, everyone, for catching that one. Yes, that is true.
All right. So we're going to go back and we're going to take one more question, I think, just in the interest of time. All right. So let's move on to our next question here. Let me launch it and I will move us forward one slide. All right. This one's a little wordy, but which of these are conducted to gather information for a community involvement plan or CIP and serve as a way to meet with community members and learn about their site-related needs, concerns, and expectations, as well as how the community gets information and prefers to receive site-related information? Is it an action memo, a public meeting, press release, proposed plan or community interviews? So you can check off your responses and then hit that submit button. And it looks like almost half of you have cast a response. Again, if you have any difficulties with those online polls, just send a message into the Q&A and that will count the same way for us. I'm going to go ahead and close this one down in 3, 2, 1. And now looking at these results. It looks like about 3/4 of the audience picked community interviews, and then about 2/3 picked public meeting with some interest in the other options. What are the right answers, Emmy?
So we were looking for E, community interviews. Though I would agree, if you held a public meeting around your community involvement plan development, that could also be a way to gather information for it. So I would accept B as well.
All right, excellent. I think in the interest of time, we might skip the next two quick questions here and carry on with the presentation.
Sounds good. We're getting towards the end of our Superfund pipeline process, at least as issuing a decision, and we're going to look at community involvement in post-ROD actions. So we're looking at if you're issuing an explanation of significant difference in ESD, or if you're looking at potentially issuing a ROD amendment. So with these changes, we're looking at those that significantly affect the remedy that was selected in the ROD and where there's additional explanation needed and perhaps additional public comment opportunity needed for that change. So we have three different types of changes. The first one might be a minor or insignificant change that you can just handle with a record, a memo to the file. This might be something like, oh, we were going to use 3-inch gravel, but we ended up going with 4-inch gravel, or some of those design changes that are made in the field. But aren't changing the remedy significantly in any way. Then we have significant changes, which would require an ESD, and then a fundamental change where your remedy is entirely a component or your entire remedy is an entirely different approach than what was identified in the original ROD. And just a side plug, we have a course that talks about the types of decision documents, RODs, and more. So check out that course if you want to get into this kind of discussion in more detail. So say it's an ESD that you're issuing. What is required? So when you issue the ESD, you want to make sure that it and all supporting information are made available in the administrative record and information repository. And the only requirement really is to publish a public notice in a newspaper that the ESD has been issued. That's the bare minimum. The site team can work together to identify if it makes sense to do more. Would it make sense to issue a fact sheet or send out a mailer or do a short video for the website that talks about what the ESD caught captured or changed? That is always an option to do more, and the site team really should be working to identify what the community would benefit from, what they need, and go beyond the minimum requirements as appropriate. Oh, one second. Apologies on my camera. Okay, so that's the requirement for ESD. Let's go now to what are the community involvement requirements if you are looking at a ROD amendment for your decision. So essentially with a ROD amendment, you're going back through the same process you had with issuing the first proposed plan and ROD. You have to issue another proposed plan for public comment. You'll publish a notice of availability of that document in the newspaper. hold that public comment period again for at least 30 days, and that can be extended for a minimum of 30 days upon timely request. That opportunity for a public meeting, and if one is held, then you keep a you provide a transcript of the public meeting as well. The response to comments, that'll be typically the last section of the the ROD amendment. And lastly, once you get through all that and issue the amended ROD, you'll have to publish a notice of availability. So you're going through that same process all over again. You cannot have a ROD amendment without issuing a proposed plan and going through the public comment process. That's one big area of confusion I've seen in interacting between EPA and the lead agencies on this topic. The idea that, oh, we'll just issue a ROD amendment. Like, whoa, whoa, there's a lot of community involvement steps that have to take place in order for that to happen, which is fine, but you just have to allow time for that in the schedule and planning for cleanup. Again, we have our figure that goes through the different things you can do based on the level of interest for your community. And now we are at 5-year reviews. So I'm going to ask Cal to come back on so she can talk to us about 5-year reviews and the community.
All righty. Thanks, Emmy. So Section 121 of CERCLA requires remedial actions that result in leaving any hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants in place be subject to a 5-year review. So every 5 years, you go back and check your work, right? The purpose is to evaluate the implementation and performance and make sure it's still protective of human health and the environment. For federal facility sites, the lead agency conducts the review, prepares the reports, and submits them to EPA and the state for review and comment. The lead agency is responsible for ensuring that the recommendations and follow-up actions that are required following the review are completed. So there's no community involvement activities required during operation and maintenance of the remedy or the 5-year review period. So not required, but 5-year reviews should include, or I guess must include, notifying the community that the review is being conducted, requesting information from the community about the site, notifying the community that the review, including a protectiveness determination, has been completed, and preparing a summary of the review and making it available at the local repository and or on the web page. So those are the requirements. But, you know, obviously in 5 years, a community can change. And so this is a really good time to assess the level of community involvement and community composition. So not mandated, but a good idea. In fact, though, the EPA 2001 Comprehensive 5-Year Review Guidance provides the policies and procedures for conducting 5-year reviews at Superfund sites. And this guidance states that the site team should consider additional community involvement activities at high-profile sites, those with significant public interest, and any other sites for which there is a need for additional community involvement activities. And, you know, this could include notifying local public officials, including local health departments or other state and local agencies and leadership notifying them of what is happening at the site. But in addition to notification, you know, the interviews with community members could be really useful, at least, you know, for those who live near or work near the site, getting their views about the current site conditions, how the cleanup is going, any problems or concerns that they may have can be very useful in preparing that 5-year review. If there was or is a citizens advisory group, representatives of these groups could be briefed, should be briefed at the outset of the 5-year review process, and if requested at any other appropriate moments. You might also want to consider appropriate ways such as public meetings or opportunities for submitting comments to get broader public involvement. Again, not mandated, but a good idea. And also, because 5 years is kind of a long time, you might want to also check community demographics to see if there have been any shifts in the past 5 years, which could call into question the protectiveness of a remedy, for example. Change in a community could result in changes in the dominant language spoke that could necessitate updates to signage, for example. Okay, so next we have another poll. Jean?
All right, sorry about that. All right, we have that poll window launched on the screen. This is a simple true/false. Is a five-year review, does that require a notice to be published in a newspaper of major circulation? Is that true or false? It looks like almost half of you have cast your vote on this one. So I'll go ahead and just close this one down in 3, 2, 1. And let's take a look. So it looks like most of the audience said that statement is true. Cal, is that true?
Actually, the answer is false. Emmy mentioned the cases where this is required, but five-year reviews are not one of them. And there are many effective methods for notifying the community, and you should use the strategies that will work best for the impacted community. Now I turn it back to Emmy.
Thank you.
Emmy, it looks like you're muted. It might have been a mistake on our end here.
There we go. Apologies. That was me. So we like to ask that question because typically people assume that's true, that you have to have this notice in a newspaper put in for your five-year reviews. Is that good practice? If that's good for your community, yes, that's great practice. But knowing what is a requirement and what is not is very important when it comes to community involvement. But more important, striving to hit that level of meaningful engagement is where we really want to be. So we're going to switch now to our last slide, which talks about technical assistance, EPA technical assistance at federal facilities on the NPL. So there are a number of opportunities we have to provide assistance. Granted, the majority of charges or costs associated with cleanup and requirements, including community involvement, comes from the lead agency. But EPA does have some resources that can also be tapped into for federal facilities. It could be a technical assistant needs assessment, a TANA, that would help determine whether an advisory group would be best served by tags, tasks, or a TAP, which we'll talk about in a second. Those are listed on the slide as well. A TAG is a technical assistance grant, and a task is another type of grant for technical assistance services for communities. And these two types of grants are available for our federal facility sites, but there is a limited pool of money. So we can't promise that every request would be met, but also there's specific criteria that has to be met in order for community groups to be able to ask for a TAG or task through EPA. TAGs provide funding to community groups where they contract their own technical advisor to help them understand technical reports or site conditions, and it can be an initial grant. The values can vary, but it could be up to $50,000 that's available to those qualified community groups. A task provides independent assistance through an EPA contract to help communities better understand, again, science, regulations, the technical aspects of the cleanup. We could provide scientists, engineers, other professionals who can speak to the group about the site. With TAP, that's the Technical Assistance for Public Participation. This is specific for RABS, for Department of Defense. So we would, I believe in your notes, there's a link to that website that provides more information. Those can be up to $25,000 per year. with a total of 100,000 per DoD installation, assuming those funds are still available. And note that the opportunity to request a TAG or task grant should be clearly identified in the community involvement plan. That language does need to be in there. So I will leave that technical assistance slide so we can come to our review and see if there's any last minute questions that we can answer. But just want to hit on how the importance of community involvement and engagement in the Superfund process, the intent that the community should be involved in the decision-making process since they are likely the most impacted by what happens in cleanup at that Superfund site. And it's not about just checking the box. We really want our site teams to go beyond those regulatory requirements to meet the intent of involvement of the community in the decision-making process.
All right, thank you so much, Emmy. I'll invite Cal to come on camera and we will walk through our final Q&A break here with the time that we have remaining. All right, I'm going to lead into a question that came in earlier regarding outreach to communities. So one of the attendees wanted to know, is there anything that's going to compel a federal agency to make sure that their outreach strategies are really tailoring to the needs of their community? They shared an example that in their case, they felt that a federal facility, the federal agency did not reach out in the native language to the indigenous people near that site. And so now they're concerned that they didn't get enough feedback or response by the community because they simply didn't reach out in a way that worked to that particular community, and they want to know what recourse might exist.
So I'll start and then Cal can jump in. If that's the situation you're in at a site where you feel the lead agency is just not listening, not meeting the needs of the community, I would always recommend reaching out to your state and federal regulators to voice your concerns. And they may share the same concerns and can reach out to the lead agency and have those discussions of what needs to be done for the site. So reach out to your regulators and ask for assistance if you feel that those needs are not being met. Cal, did you have other thoughts?
There are ways to elevate issues if you do get hit these obstacles. So, but it's a process, and but the EPA and the state should be happy to kind of work through this process to make sure that the community needs are met.
All right, excellent. We did have a clarification. Is it the lead agency that's taking care of all of the community involvement requirements?
I would say the lead agency is responsible for conducting or meeting those requirements. But the regulators also ensure that the requirements are known and met. So it is, again, a team effort.
Yeah, and
No.
just to build on that though, it building trust, within the community is it can be tough. And so what we see is that sometimes it may be easier or more effective for like a state regulator to step up and be the initial face of engagement. So depends on, ideally when teams work together, you get better communication and outreach.
All right. Just a quick clarification. Do you need to send advance notice of those public meetings within a specific amount of time?
With those, I know some federal facility agreements, not the NCP, but the FFAs will set an amount of time that need of notice that's required before a public meeting. The NCP itself, to the best of my recollection, does not specify an amount of time needed for notice before a public meeting, but you want ideally 2 to 3 weeks is the sweet spot for making that known. It's not too far in advance that people forget, and not so late that you can't make plans to attend. So 2 to 3 weeks is the guideline.
All right. We have a few comments about ways to interact or communicate with the community. And there was one attendee who chimed in and noted that in tribal scenarios, you should add native radio stations as a method to do outreach. So I'm seeing some nods from you that that's a great recommendation. And then also a comment that a lot of newspapers are not circulated as a paper product anymore, that they've switched over to digital versions. So they're just wondering if there's thoughts about updating our requirements to be more broad and say that we need to use digital communications like radio, TV, social media, and these digital print or digital newspaper products.
The 2015 effort really did try to get to that point, but for those six specific situations we identified where they still require it be put in a newspaper of major circulation, that is what it is. And we would need a lot of cooperation to be able to update the NCP on that end, which I don't see happening in the near future. So definitely hear you and agree with you. We're just tied to the requirements as they are today.
Okay. All right. And then we have a few seasoned community involvement coordinators who are on the training today, and they just made an observation that a 5-year review is a great time to also consider updating your community involvement plan. So I wanted to thank them. I'm getting thumbs up and nods. Also a great tip from a pro. So thank you for sharing that comment. One of the attendees has just sort of circled back to that idea. Again, they, in their case, required activities are simply not being met by the facilities, and they're concerned that they won't listen to EPA. So, what is their advice? What is the recourse when they think there's an issue? What do they do?
So if the required activities, and we're talking about community involvement activities, are not being met, so there's the black and white of a requirement in the NCP and the lead agency does not meet it. That is where you can still reach out to your regulators, because in the federal facility agreements, there's a process where the regulators or the lead agency can raise those issues in a very formal way, and it goes up the various chains of management. And it can get resolved that way. So it goes out of the project team to their managers, and so on until it's resolved. And it's a very strong argument to say you are not meeting the requirements of the NCP, and you need to. Usually we don't get any pushback on that kind of argument. If it's in that gray area where you should be doing better at community involvement and you're not, again, coming back to reaching out to your regulators so those discussions can happen and then be raised internally to get it resolved. I know that's not the best answer you were hoping to hear, but that essentially is how it works.
All right. Well, I don't see any other questions right now in the queue, and I'm mindful of the time as 2:57 p.m. Eastern. So, Emmy, any final thoughts before I walk through our final reminders for the audience?
Just a big thank you to everyone for participating today. Thank you, Cal, for sharing your expertise, and a plug for our other webinar topics if you want to learn more about tribal coordination and consultation at federal facility sites. We have a course for that. You want to learn more about rods and ESDs, we have a course for that. And if you want to learn more about 5-year reviews, please check out our Federal Facility Academy webinars for the rest of the year. Thank you, everyone.
All right, thank you so much, Emmy. I'm going to
Thank
take
you.
over here and go through just a few quick final reminders and then close out today's session. So I did note that at the beginning, a number of you indicated interest in learning more about interacting with tribes. So just to reinforce Emmy's comment, there are additional sessions coming up in the future deliveries. December 12th session will focus on coordinating with tribes at federal facilities. So I encourage you to visit the link or visit us at CLUIN and sign up for the upcoming sessions. All right, just walking through a few quick reminders. If you are not already subscribed to our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, I send that out on the first of each month, and we'll highlight free online information sessions like today's, as well as point out other resources, websites, and events related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. So I do strongly encourage you to visit us at cluin.org and sign up for that monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. If you weren't here at the beginning, just a gentle reminder, there is a unique seminar homepage. The URL is shown in red for today's event. That website will be available from today forward and contains all sorts of information about our session, including links to the participant manual, which contains not only the slides, but a lot of supplemental resources and links. Links to some of the most important websites that were highlighted today, and information about our speakers, and a link to our online feedback form. I will note that there was a request for a print version of that Superfund website that Emmy was highlighting, and we did share that in the meeting chat an image file that you can download, and we'll make sure to include that and add that here to the seminar homepage. If anybody had any issues accessing the links, again, I encourage you to visit the CLUIN homepage for the event, and we do have those websites bookmarked individually. At this point, this website is open from today forward, so feel free to bookmark it and reference it later on. Now, today's session is available for feedback, and that is the way you can request a participation certificate. So particularly if you're interested in documenting your attendance, please visit the seminar homepage, scroll down to the section on the feedback form, and complete that form, making sure that you check the box certifying you were here for the entire delivery. Once you check that box and submit your feedback, you'll then immediately have access to download or print out a participation certificate. We'll also email a copy, but those sometimes get caught up by junk or spam filters, so I encourage you to download it right from that confirmation screen. If you hosted a viewing party, and I love it when people do that, and you had other people join you at your location, please simply share that link to the seminar homepage shown in red, and make sure that the others who joined you send in their own feedback to get their own certificate. Even though they didn't register on their own, they can still share their feedback, check that box, and get their own certificate for their own record. And our session was recorded, so if you are one of the lucky ones, you can still go back to that seminar homepage to access these files, information, links, and fill out that online feedback form. In fact, right about now in the archive session, above my head in the recorded version, there will be a button that will point to the seminar feedback form. You can fill that form out, checking the box that you replayed the entire archive, and then again, you'll have access to one of those certificates of participation. Usually takes me about a week to get the archive up, so you'll get an automatic email from me once that session is available for on-demand playback, and I encourage you to send it around and share with colleagues. So with that, a great big thank you to our presenters who shared their information, and a big thank you to that live audience who joined us for our session from all over the United States. With that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's broadcast. I hope I'll see you on a future session. Thank you so very much for joining us.